Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I wanted to ask the question, and people reflect on this. What would someone with the genetic endowment of Christ say about the state of the environment? Would he join Wall Street or street protests?
I'm Sarah Wilson, and this is Wild, a show where we talk with the biggest minds in the world about the ideas that can help us love and save our one wild and precious life together on this planet. Today's guest is dead wild. George Paxinos is one of the world's most prominent scientists, who you've probably never heard of. He has identified and named more parts of the brain than anyone in history. He's also written 57 books about the brain, one of which is the third most cited science book in the world. George is also a climate activist who, in a desperate act, his words, at 78, has published a novel about a female scientist who clones Jesus as an upriver parable to inspire climate action. The resulting Jesus clone twin boys that she produces go on to wrestle the climate crisis via the moral compass of the Saviour, forcing the reader to ask, what would Jesus do? Would he side with Wall Street or with the street protesters? The book took George 21 years to write, which makes the 7 years I took to write First We Make the Beast Beautiful look kind of speedy. And I'll just toss in a few more bio notes on George because they are impressive. He is an Order of Australia. He was raised in Ithaca in Greece, but studied at Berkeley, McGill and Yale. He's a professor at Neuroscience Research Australia and the University of New South Wales. He's president of Australia's Neuroscience Society and the World Congress. And he has won scores of awards from institutions from the British Medical Association to the prestigious Academy of Athens. He's also a mad cyclist and ran for the Australian Cyclist Party and fought for the light rail that we now have here in Sydney. I thoroughly enjoyed this chat, and our aim, I guess, was to wrestle out this one wild idea. Are their brains big enough or good enough to save the mess we have made on this planet? Welcome to Wild, George Paxinos.
Thank you, Sarah. Pleasure to be here.
Oh, I love that we're speaking in a studio here together. You discovered a stain or a chemical, I guess, that allowed you to map bits of the brain almost like a kid's colouring in book. But you studied maths and you studied psychology and a bit of philosophy as well, and you're not an anatomist. How the hell did you become the world's most famous brain mapper?
It was riding a stain. It used to be said that the gain in the brain is mainly in the stain. I introduced a way of coloring the brain that revealed its parts in far more detail and far more accuracy than previously. So I didn't need to be a neuroanatomist.
I should actually point out to everyone listening that recently the model that you created, so using this particular stain, was compared with the new online atlas from the Allen Institute, which is a multi-million dollar American organization that employs like more than 100 researchers. And they compared it with your modeling, and you're a team of one or two, and yours was declared way more superior, despite all of that money and everything. So kudos to you. But can you tell us how much of the human brain has been mapped?
Right. Firstly, the Allen Institute does many good things in this effort that they made to produce an atlas of the mouse brain. They were not as good as my laboratory. Now, on how much has been mapped of the brain in the so-called subcortex, the one below the covering, that we know pretty well of the human. The cortex is the big battle because that's also where many of the interesting things occur, emotions, higher cognitive functioning. We are still worried. We don't have a good map of the human cortex. And we're trying now with a new approach, which is using MRI because it has some advantages over the stains that I've been using traditionally. This is that the MRI can give you the directions of communication between neurons, the pathways, colored in fact, if they are from left to right, connecting the two hemispheres, it is red. If it is up and down, it is blue. And if it's anterior-posterior, then it is green. So you have some additional information with this approach. And it is this what we are doing just now in my lab. One of my colleagues had the courage to stay for 40 hours in the magnet, on and off, of course, over a lengthy period. We have obtained images from his brain that we believe are unsurpassed. And this way, we think we will be able to do a new map of the living human brain that will be accurate.
That's incredible. I mean, that's a massive step forward. Mm. So well done on that. I've heard you say that you don't actually think the brain is such a big deal. I mean, we tend to think that it is. We think it's the seat of a whole bunch of things that define us as an individual, and we hold it in awe almost. But you, I think, tend to say that it's not really worthy of that. Why is that? Given that it's what you do for a living.
Yes, certainly never since Narcissus fell in love with the reflection of his face on the river has there been such an admiration of a bodily organ as there is now of the brain, the decade of the brain, the century of the brain, but never with as little justification. If you consider that the brain is really the human brain, is 1.3 kilos. It's really impressive in that sense. But beyond that, it is made in the same pattern as the brain of a chimpanzee. The greatest surprise that I've had as a scientist is that there are no regions of the human brain that are different, additional than what you find in the chimpanzee brain. So in whatever else, Sarah, you might resemble the divine. In your brain, you're made in the image of the chimpanzee. And of course, it is larger than expected by our body size. So it's a species specialization, much like the giraffe has a large neck, we have a large brain. But this structural advantage, this marginal superiority has led to the hubris that we are made in the image of God. The ancients didn't have a good view of such claims. You might have come across Sisyphus. I told my granddaughter of 8 years of age, this king was condemned by the gods to push a rock all the way up the hill, only to fall down again and have to push it back up the hill because he was narcissistic, egotistical, and insulting. And she said, like Trump.
Is that what she said? I love that.
Yeah, so the hubris was not appreciated by the ancient gods.
I want to just go back to your idea on the brain. Is it the seat of the soul or consciousness? I mean, a lot of people think it is. What's your take?
Well, thank you for firstly considering all good things that should belong to the brain. This hasn't been always appreciated that the brain does a few things. Indeed, the ancient Egyptians heedlessly discarded the brain in funerary practices and sent millennia of pharaohs brainless to their afterlife. It was Hippocrates, the greatest doctor of antiquity, who said men ought to know that from the brain, our brain alone, derive our joys, laughters, and jests, as well as our sorrows, griefs, and tears. But unfortunately, Aristotle, who comes later than Hippocrates, took a different view that the brain was there to cool the blood, air conditioning.
Is that right?
Great as a scientist he was, he mistook this, and the professor's greatness is measured by how long they managed to stymie progress in their field. And his adherents kept this erroneous idea going for thousands of years. It was someone else, however, who was battling it, Galen, who was an admirer of Hippocrates, and he formulated the encephalocentric view of the soul, as it was called then, and the two battled each other out until the dawn of modern age. And you have now Shakespeare in The Merchant of Venice. Portia asks, where is fancy bred, fancy being love, or in the heart, or in the head? But if you go today to Bondi Junction to find a card to send to your loved one, you will be confronted, certainly on the day of St. Valentine's, with
a lot of hearts.
About 300 cards, each one with at least one red heart on it. None of them with the
brain.
I was forced to write a letter in the newspaper, "Darling, I love you from the bottom of my brain." I got a call from a journalist in the ABC Melbourne. "Are you insisting that the heart has nothing to do with love?" And I said, "If in a heart transplant," I said to her, "I receive your heart, I am not going to fall in love with your husband." And she said, "What a pity. And he's such a lovely man."
Is that a true story?
Yeah, it's a true story.
You're very mischievous. What is your take now? Do you think the brain is the site of the soul, or is it just a sort of a organ that takes in stimulus and spits out response?
It certainly does the latter. As it concerns soul, first question is, does it exist? And then you can ask whether it is in the brain. The concept that is adhered by a large in neuroscience is that if the soul is where sensations become perceptions, where reasoning takes place, where decisions are made, where love is manufactured, where memories are stored, then there is no reason to assume there is a soul, because there is already an organ which undertakes these functions. So the brain does these things that we used to attribute to the soul. And we call that, of course, the mind. And I can tell that you would have worries that, okay, have you substituted the word soul with mind? What have you gained? Well, you've gained something in the sense that you don't have to deal with immortality. Then so mind for the neuroscientist is the integration of the activity of the brain. Once that activity ceases, so does the mind. You might say, is that nonetheless something different than matter? Neuroscientists believe that it is just matter. It's really just the activity of the brain, electrical, chemical, physical, nothing else. But the neuroscientists cannot answer the fundamental question, which is, what is consciousness? They really are confused. But they don't run up to the mountains to seek answers in gurus. They do know something about consciousness, and they know that it's the activity of the brain in the following way. We are more conscious. We have a high degree of consciousness. Right now, we are adults. Both of us were not embryos. If we were embryos, we would have very little of it, or if any. And if you look at a different dimension from in the evolutionary scale, that is, where is consciousness arising? You will find certainly it's present in all mammals, certainly in chimpanzee, in all mammals, in fact, in the small mouse, probably in the octopus.
Well, that's been shown, hasn't it?
Yeah. Right. So therefore, you can see its proxies, evidence for it, but we don't know how it arises, that a material thing gives rise to the pleasure of seeing the rainbow, the feeling of you're in love. These, what the philosophers called qualia, we do not know. But the idea today in neuroscience that it has to be the brain, and the brain is responsible for even the decisions that you make, your behavior, that is.
And also this idea of free will. We as humans don't like the idea that we're just a bunch of synapses reacting and responding and absorbing, and that we are all sort of the same. We like the idea that there is an element of free will. There's an element of individual identity. And I think that that's what we grapple with. And neuroscientists or scientists in general and philosophers have different approaches to that and different levels of comfort with to what extent they can pinpoint the soul.
Yeah, well, the freedom, the will, is an illusion, according to neuroscientists. That's, of course, the majority view. There are others who dispute that. But even the ones who argue in favor of the existence of free will, it's a modicum of free will that they argue for. And this is, even the law considers that, and there's no retributive, to some extent, there's no retributive justice. And the concept is that our behavior is the outcome of two and only two factors. That is, the genetic endowment, which we have no control over, and the environmental influences on it, which again, we have no control over. And indeed, it is nature via nurture. It's both. Different environments will sculpt different characters, behaviors, even in identical twins. And this is indeed the story in my novel.
Exactly. Well, let's move on to that, because I have read most of your book. You've been an activist all your life, from what I can gather, a climate activist. You were pivotal in New South Wales in terms of getting a light rail, and we've got the light rail literally outside the studio. You also ran for the Australian Cyclists Party, and I think I crossed paths with you in that era. It took you 21 years to write a novel, but it's recently been published. Why did you decide a novel was the way to go?
A failure led to fiction. Yes, it was a defeat at the hands of governments in everything I tried, because light rail back then was defeated in the 80s when I tried to reintroduce trams to Sydney. And for a decade, I was thinking, if only I could write an environmental novel, eco-fiction, so that I would take the reader with me, then I would not have to try to stop someone from cutting a tree, working upstream of behavior at attitude, and change their attitude so that they would not want to cut the tree. But I couldn't come up with an idea of a novel until Christmas party, where someone said to me, I hear you're going to Spain. Why don't you go and see San Juan de Compostela, where the bones of St. James are buried? And I thought at that moment, why not get some DNA and see what the guy looks like? And then I thought, why not somebody far more significant? I told my friends the plot.
I might just explain to people roughly what the plot is without giving too much away. So the book basically sees this character, Evelyn, a female scientist. She discovers the remains of what she believes to be Jesus in Israel, and she sneaks out the DNA from the bones. Then she clones it and creates two embryos. She gives birth to one, and then the other is sent to South America, and a surrogate gives birth to the other one. So both boys, these twin boys, these clones of Jesus, live, I think, in roughly current times. So yes, please continue and explain why you use this plot line to engage people more in this sort of upstream version of the climate movement.
I wanted to ask the question, and people reflect on this. What would someone with the genetic endowment of Christ say about the state of the environment? Would he join Wall Street or street protests? What we need today, I think, is a reset of religion. The overpopulation of the planet has to be considered, which is not sufficiently, because of unfortunate stance of religions, and that science have to reset. Community, culture has to reset. It requires a reset as the one that was seen back then when the early Christians established their communities. That was the idea, but to actually flesh it, I thought it would take me half a year, but it wasn't. 21 years later, somebody saw me, a friend in Bondi Junction, on a cafe, writing it as where I usually go and ride in the Athens of the South, as the junction we like to call now, in the intellectually fertile crescent between Woolworths, Coles, and Target.
Wow.
And she said, how is the book going? As she would always ask over the last decades. And I said, 21 years and it's not finished yet. And she said, my cousin's novel was published posthumously. I said, you're giving me hope.
Was it also motivation to get the damn thing out there?
I was never got tired of the book. And I attribute this, unlike my academic books, where I really get tired by the end. And when they finish, I really get tired of them. This one, I wasn't. And I attribute this to the fact that it was so poor to start with, that I was always making improvements. It always became better every time I was working on it. So I had reinforcement. I was improving.
I like that attitude. And I should just say it took me 7 years to write one of my books and 3 years to write another. And I'm exactly the same. And eventually my publisher just has to come and grab it from me and go, we've got to press print on this, because I could literally enjoy tinkering it forever.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
I want to get onto some of the philosophical quandaries that your novel poses. But first of all, can I ask if the science in the book, this idea of being able to clone the DNA of Jesus Christ, is it plausible?
All but that.
Oh.
It is plausible. Cloning from desiccated tissue or well-preserved histologically, there's no evidence that this can be done. If it were frozen, yes. So the way I introduced it is that the ancients had some way of preserving the tissue structure, the DNA integrity. This suspense of belief, then it's up to the reader.
Yeah. In the end, it's a parable, so you're allowed to introduce those elements. So look, the book poses a bunch of questions, which I really enjoyed wrestling with as I was reading it. I guess the first is goodness inherited? Is it nature or is it nurture or is it something else?
That's right. This is exactly what Evelyn was contemplating. Am I going to produce a Christ or could it be an antichrist? Her theoretical conclusion is that if you clone yeast, you get yeast. You don't get Drosophila. Mm. So there will be a genetic predisposition to the extent that the DNA of Christ were of the better quality as it concerns those issues of goodness. And in other words, Christ had a genetic predisposition. And indeed, in fashioning the characters, I took that into consideration. There is evidence from identical twins, even raised apart, that many traits are similar. The environment will differentiate the characters. And indeed, someone from the East suburbs of Sydney and an identical twin of his in the slums of Buenos Aires will develop differences depending on who mentors them, what they meet in life.
Can we talk a little bit about how that nurture element, the fact that you grew up in the eastern suburbs of Sydney versus the slums and hardship and seeing the same climate crisis through a different lens? Talk us through some of the explorations there. What did that reveal as you were writing in terms of, I guess it's the global north versus the global south, funnily enough, you know, to what it says about, you know, your background and where you grow up?
That's right. Both characters, Christopher and Jose, had an interest in the environment, but from diametrically opposed points of view. Christopher was a businessman and looked at the prospects of producing green energy, which if you don't produce that, then you keep burning fossil fuels, which would convert the Amazon into a savanna through global warming. Jose was looking at it that any dam you produce, you actually then produce oxygen poor zones downstream of the dam, that then the river's Amazon would be inhospitable to a number of species, and that the dams to be constructed produce so much CO2. And the fact that the vegetation in the drawdown zone decomposes under anaerobic conditions, and it will contribute more CO2 than the city of São Paulo. That was his standard measure. They were looking at the same thing, but from different points of view. Jose was mentored by a professor who had a passion for the environment and was schooled in those details that Christopher was looking in this adroit way of going and forcing nature to do what you want it to do. And Jose was viewing a nature as saintly, that you cannot disturb it, that you cannot damage this Amazon, this source of life and inspiration.
Yeah, I very much see it as almost a masculine versus a feminine approach. And I also live in the eastern suburbs of Sydney, not far from you, and I'm surrounded by tech bros, you know, with the latest regenerative farming app that they're trying to get funding for, etc. And it's very much a top-down approach, and it's about mitigation. And then you have in other countries, and nearby we've got the Pacific nations who are now looking at adaptation as well. So you also see that mitigation versus adaptation thing playing out. The book begs another question, and that is this idea of the DNA from some humans, some great humans in history, whether it be Jesus or Gandhi or Einstein, are they better or big enough to fix the problems of our time?
Right. Even Einstein could not foresee the consequences of his own theories. And I have heard that when he was told that the construction of an atomic weapon is possible, he said, "Tell me it is not true." If you consider those great minds in the 50s, the 60s, virtually none mentioned the environmental issue. It was there then. The conditions were set from 100 years before then, but they were not that perceptive. So to admit what we are, I don't think that the great minds will solve things. It was top graduates from Harvard that took us to Vietnam.
Yes, I think it's a really interesting point. If I hear you correctly, what you're saying is that our brains are big enough to cause the problems in the first place. So our hunger for more knowledge and our curiosity, it's substantial enough to go and create these big problems, but it's not big enough to be able to then solve the problems that we create, but also to foresee where it will land us. So you're saying that even Einstein and these Harvard graduates, they could only go so far. So off the back of that, George, what do you conclude?
I conclude we are in such difficulty. In other words, if you only look at what the brain makes us come up with in Australia, the first continent to be degraded by climate change, in the wake of the largest fires in recorded history, and before the almost certain loss of all corals in the Great Barrier Reef and elsewhere, and the consequent simplification of life in the oceans, Australia is the largest exporter of brown coal in the world. And Australia not only does not carry its own weight in the climate change issue, but is interfering with global action to stabilize the climate. If that is not an indication that the brain is not the right size, I don't know what would be. So I am really asking for a reset, a reflection of who we are, and that we are another primate on the planet to understand that we are not that different from other primates, that we managed to rise to where we are, but at the same time we constructed the conditions for our demise, and that we are not as clever as we think we are. Reflect on who you are. And of course, there have been many great people who reflected on that. Consider Darwin, about who we are. The human exceptionalism was defeated just then, you would have thought. But no, it's alive and well in many places. So just reflect that we are looking at our own demise in more and more starkly. The evidence is there, and we are not listening to the scientists. Paradoxical as it is, because we listened to them when it came to COVID, but not the climate scientists, and we berate them. So reflect, stop and reflect. Look at the population. The first thing that the society could make a big progress on, that twice as many people, it means twice as much damage to the land, air, and seas. So that's what I am asking, a reset.
It's really interesting, actually. Have you ever heard of the philosopher and scientist David Chalmers? He's an Australian who's been working overseas for many years. He was my professor when I was in Santa Cruz in a course called Philosophy of the Universe, and we had to come up with an alternate theory for black hole. Honestly, I was 21 at the time and well out of my depth, but he's gone on. I've followed his work ever since, and he talks about this thing called the hard problem, and he says that our brains will never be able to solve consciousness, to actually be able to articulate what consciousness is. And it's a similar kind of thing, isn't it? So it keeps us in this grip of uncertainty and fear and doubt until we die, because we will never be able to explain it. And he has looked at it deeply from a philosophical point of view and said, we just don't have the brains big enough. It's kind of what you're saying, isn't it?
That's right. I mean, you wouldn't expect calculus from a cockroach. Just not enough synaptic buffer. It'll learn some things, but not do calculus. What I am hoping people will do is to understand who we are, that is, some humility and not hubris, and accordingly behave. We don't trust nuclear weapons to children, but we trust them to Putin and to Trump, and to soon every nation will have the capacity to destroy all life on the earth, and some, either through accident or through intent, to meet their God, may well do it.
So if we don't have a brain large enough to solve it, what you're saying is almost to take it back, pair it back to a philosophical and sort of moral standpoint, where we get humble enough to realize that and go, before we go and make some big change or allow an invention to just be placed on the planet, let's realize we're not smart enough to solve this if we stuff it up.
Exactly. A self-understanding, this is what I'm calling for. More likely, I will just be ignored, as most novels are.
Yep, I get it. One little question I had along the way, actually, and it's apropos nothing at all, but I love that your central character is a 40-something woman. She's the hero of the book. What's the reason behind that?
In life, you meet people, and I met a lady, and I told her, actually, that she was my heroine in the novel I was writing, a lady who was working in the lab, brain surgery, on the day before Christmas. And I thought, this is a dedicated scientist. Evelyn has her personality difficulties. You might have seen in people around us that a love early on that you cannot shake off.
Yes.
And the ghost of a departed, a dead love is killing all future ones. She thought of finding love one day, and thought that actually giving birth to not only a child, but also an idea would be for her.
The idea being bringing Christ back to the planet at a time when we are facing such existential despair.
And correcting the greatest injustice. She had the background for it, in the sense that she was working on the thylacine, the Tasmanian tiger.
Yes.
Project was stopped, and she could not complete it. She thought she was on the right track. She was hoping to see the Tasmanian tiger grace Tasmanian forests again.
I think for a 78-year-old man to be able to conjure up the battle that so many women face, where you feel you have to decide between giving birth to a child and having love via that avenue, or giving birth to an idea via career or creation or whatever. You write about it particularly well, I thought, just that struggle that every woman who's listening to this, they know what you and I are talking about here.
But I started 21 years before that.
In a previous interview, when I was just sort of researching for this chat here with you, George, I've heard you say that, you know, the Enlightenment period is well and truly over and that we are heading into darker times. And I take that to mean intellectually and morally, and that we're sort of devolving to a certain extent. Explain why you feel this way.
It was a time in human history, the Enlightenment period, 1600s, 1700s, where people thought, at least enough of them, critical mass, and the culmination of it was, of course, French Revolution, the Greek Revolution, the American Revolution, the American Constitution, that we should not any longer obey dogma, but we should be guided by science and the principles of individual freedom and equality amongst people. And we saw in recent years with the structures are threatened. That is, the fossil fuel industry, they have $39 trillion in assets, and they will be stranded if society does what it must, not use them. And they have the capacity to buy as many national party people as you want. And you have things mentioned in parliament that go against science. And of course, you have had the rise of Trump in the US and other dictators elsewhere. The irony of it that as long as the information before was cured by journalists who had some professional ethics to adhere to, you could actually get, by and large, some good information. And now with this freedom that anyone can, even you and you right now in your podcast,
yes,
can actually give voice and microphone to thoughts that have not been passed through any filter of some norm, that is expectations, that is you expect to give a fair hearing in, if you're a good journalist. And this is, any one of us now is a journalist, and we can then self-reinforce ideas, it seems.
It's a very good parallel for what you're saying more broadly as to what's happening in the climate crisis and the Goldilocks brain syndrome. We've got a brain that's big enough to go, freedom, yes, that's what we need. That sounds like a great idea, right? Yes. A whole bunch of white men saying they need more freedom, but a not big enough brain to go, oh, hang on, where could this end up? And does it serve our humanity? And does it serve what we as humans know to be true at our ethical core? We've lost that balance, haven't we, George, between the collective and the individual, which we used to have via these institutions that very much came out of the Enlightenment, that ensured that there were sort of gatekeepers and referees on the field that would make sure individualism didn't run rampant and kill the collective. I really like that idea of the Goldilocks brain. It's the fact that we're not quite smart enough, are we? We're smart enough to create the problem, not smart enough to cure it. And therefore, we end up being a species in a petri dish eating itself up.
Sarah, I'm glad that you picked up on this Goldilocks issue, because this phrase, Goldilocks, I have relation to the brain. I've used it only this hour with you. But indeed, the issue of the Enlightenment and the coming Enlightenment, when I came to Australia, I felt I was coming to an even more enlightened country than the US, where I was previously. At 5 o'clock at Yale, the color of the people would change from the whites who were the professors to the blacks who came to clean. And I came here and I saw that the garbage collectors were white. This was uplifting. And people would call me mate, as they would call, say, mate. And I thought they were actually saying Mike. And I said, no, George. George is my name. Then I realized that it was mate. That is not a word that's used in North America at that time anyway. I felt that this country was doing well. I saw erosion of some of this. I saw the exacerbation, worsening of the distances between the haves and have-nots. And one thing you know from psychology, from education, it is what you invest in it. And this is for now and for later in life. That is, even whether you will be dementing early or not, Sarah, depends in the first instance in what family you were born in. Was it rich? And then you have an advantage on many other things, of course, including the cycling that you do, which is as protective as anything. But can you do cycling without actually risking your life in Sydney? This issue has impact on even the motivation. They would blame, for example, those children from or adults from poor areas. They don't have to get up and go. Motivation itself is environmentally caused as much as any other behavior, or influenced, if not caused.
If I hear you right, George, really what you're putting forward as a solution, as a way for us to feel that we might be able to do something to save ourselves, you're asking us to reflect on the fact that we don't have big enough brains to solve a lot of the problems that we cause. And so, you know, take a breath, regroup, refocus before we do something. I mean, really, that's kind of what your book is saying. And I'm wondering whether you have hope then. If you have hope for Australia with our new government, which I think is probably more capable of nuance and more considered debate on these really ethical, fundamental issues that go to the heart of the identity of Australia, but also more broadly when we're talking the climate crisis, do you have hope that we might be able to learn this reflective process?
You identified well the issues of humility and not hubris. As to hope, indeed, I saw the nice outcome of the election in that there were some Greens elected and some independents. And that's a good development for Australia. As to whether that will be enough, Australia will still be the largest exporter of coal for many years to come, which is burning us. And I think that there is no hope, but at the same time, there's nothing more important than try to construct a sustainable society.
And is that your sort of almost prognosis for living a good life?
Yes, even at the interpersonal level, you will meet with people who would have similar views, and you'll commiserate together. And indeed, the brain is not geared to be depressed, to make you depressed for the end of the world. If you have a sliver under your thumb, that is really what motivates you. And there are many beautiful things to enjoy in life. Sitting in a room with many other people, my one-year-old grandson rushed through the room to come and hug my legs. Well, that is beautiful. And there are more important things than all that. The priority of the things we should attend to them first, because all other causes were fighting for, unless the environmental cause is actually won, all else is irrelevant.
I have a question that I ask many of my guests at the end of the interview, and it's this, and it's from a question that Eric Fromm posed in the wake of sort of the nuclear proliferation in the 60s. And he said, what is left if we lose it all? And I think you've almost answered the question. What matters to humans? What matters to you as a human, George, if there is no hope?
Yes, the fact that I will see my children today matters more than all else, even the causes I fight for. This is the way I think we are programmed. The brain has kept us alive because of these pleasures. to protect the next generation. There are many depressing things that will happen in one's life, but they are the things that you see that your nightingales are still singing, even after you know that your demise is coming not long from now. It is the way we were constructed. If only we could harness some of the predilections that nature has encephalized, placed in our brains, and use them to also achieve the collective, not the individual, I will feel happy with my children, and I will be keep worrying about the environment, including their future. But if only we could join in this predilection to love, the overall scheme of things.
To take the love we feel for our close kin, that's sort of quite an individual way of looking at things, and extend it out to the collective. I work to a very similar notion, and in my most recent book, I pose this idea that we as humans will fight to save what we love. And so we will do anything to save our child. And if we could see that carried over into nature, and I feel, and I suspect you feel the same way, if we can reintroduce people to nature and our love of it, then perhaps we will fight for it too.
Love is the answer.
I love that coming from a neuroscientist. It's wonderful. Thank you, George. That was a wonderful conversation. And I am going to put my hand up, actually, to attend one of your philosophy evenings. I understand you hold them on a regular basis, so I would love to join sometime.
It'll be a pleasure to have you. You would be a great sophist. That's what we call ourselves, so that we don't expect a lot of ourselves. And if I can wish to your listeners that their brain shrinks less than what expected from their age.
That's a lovely way to sign off. Thank you, George. So some take-homes that I took from the conversation on some reflection are this. Be humble. Our brains are just not that great, and they will destroy us if we don't take stock of this. The other one is to reflect more, you know, discuss issues and pause, get into the granular stuff and negotiate and do some sense making before acting. And I guess this is the note that George left us with. And I suppose there's this one too that George left us with. Love our way to action. All right, everyone. So until next time, love wildly.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.